Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with outgoing Tulane University President Scott Cowan, whose new book is The Inevitable City, The Resurgence of New Orleans and the Future of Urban America. We'll also hear from Stephen Ray, who's one of the celebrity readers at the annual Bloomsday celebration of James Joyce's Ulysses. And I'll have some thoughts on summer reading. Scott Cowan is the outgoing president of Tulane University, the 14th president in the university's history. Time magazine has named him one of America's 10 best college presidents, and New Orleans City Business called him one of the 30 driving forces in New Orleans over the past 30 years. We'll be talking about his new book, The Inevitable City, The Resurgence of New Orleans, and the Future of Urban America. Scott Cowan, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. Delighted to be with you.
Now, this is a remarkable kind of farewell to your experience at Tulane. So when you look back at this time period, what is the thing you're proudest of?
Without a doubt, it's our recovery from Hurricane Katrina. Mm-hmm. After Katrina, I wasn't really sure that the university would be able to survive. And then when I was convinced it would survive, I wasn't sure that it would ever get back to the stature and reputation it had before the storm. And my proudest moment is, I can say, I think with a great deal of confidence today, Tulane is stronger and better than it was before Katrina, and probably stronger and better than it would have been if Katrina hadn't happened.
Wow, that's amazing.
That's an amazing statement. I'm sad to say it, but I think it's true. And I also think it's true about New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. So do you have any regrets about what's happened over that time period?
You always have regrets, Susan, because you always wish you had done more of this or more of that. So I always wished that we had raised more money than we raised. I wish that somehow our retention rates and graduation rates would have gone up at a faster rate than they have. So most of the regrets are just, I wish things had improved even more than they have improved. Mm-hmm. I don't look back and say, was there some huge mistake we made in the aftermath of Katrina? I don't think that's the case. It is just, could we have done it faster and been more efficient at what we did?
So you're a busy guy. You know, you're an executive, you're an educator, you're many things to many people. So writing is something you have to kind of squeeze in around the edges. And you wrote this book with a co-author, Betsy Seifter. So what was that experience like for you?
Well, it was very interesting. I've actually known Betsy for 30 years. We're family friends, and we go back. We have spent some time together during the summers, our families. And I always knew that Betsy had a literary background. So when I was thinking about somebody to work with me on this, I was thinking about somebody where there would be good chemistry, mm-hmm. that they knew me already, they knew how I spoke, how I thought, and I decided to do it with Betsy, and I could not have found a better partner, quite honestly. She was able, and many times, to capture my voice around certain stories or ways of saying things that, quite honestly, were better than I thought of myself. So it turned out to be a very, very productive partnership. I couldn't be more delighted.
Did she record you a lot?
She did. Uh-huh. Matter of fact, we had, I can't tell you, hundreds of hours of interviews, and of course, then going back on writing of the manuscript back and mm-hmm. forth. She was able to do some of the background research in certain areas to fill in the blanks from my stories. So she was invaluable, and she was surprised I put her name on the book, because a lot of times those that you collaborate.
People don't.
But my view was that she deserved credit for a lot of what was in that book.
Yeah.
Whatever mistakes there are, they're mine, they're my stories, it's my tale, but Betsy really helped make it come alive on a piece of paper.
So what was it like for you to look back over this experience and try and shape this narrative of your life? I mean, did it change you? Did it bring anything into the foreground for you that hadn't been there before, perhaps?
You know, Katrina was a transformative experience for all of us, and it was for me personally. It changed me in very profound ways. For example, I never envisioned when I moved here in the 1990s that when I stepped down from the presidency, we would stay in New Orleans, but of course we're going to. my whole feeling about the city and about how it recovered and about leadership have been shaped by the Katrina experience. So it's changed me a lot, quite honestly. And what the book has been is it's been therapeutic. In the sense is all of these stories were in my head for years, and I just couldn't get them out because they were too emotional for me. But when I actually started the discipline of writing the book and with Betsy, it was therapeutic to begin to write about how I felt and what happened. And I also think it's a remarkable story. It's a remarkable story for New Orleans and for other urban areas around the country to hear about. So we read now today about Detroit and what Detroit's going through, and people right. there wondering whether Detroit can recover. I think there's lots of lessons here about what we did in New Orleans, positive and negative, I might add, that are germane to Detroit or Cleveland or any city in the country. So I see this book as having multiple audiences, those in urban areas where they're trying to transform or rebuild their own areas, those who are interested in leadership, and there's some principles of leadership there. And I think it also has interest to people who are just interested in stories. And there's some interesting stories
there. There's some great stories in here. And it's interesting because it is that kind of three-part book, you know. And I'm curious whether you found that your philosophy of leadership had been there all along and Katrina brought it out, or whether you were writing about it a bit in retrospect after analyzing your own actions.
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, my experience both in the military back in the 1960s as an infantry officer, as being a student athlete in college, I think there were a lot of lessons of leadership I learned then that I did apply during Katrina. And then I think there's new lessons I learned after Katrina that probably were rumbling around in my mind, but I had never been able to articulate that now are articulated in the book.
Well, you know, you live in one of the most famous houses in New Orleans, and I think a lot of people pass by that house wistfully. So I wonder if you'd read a little bit from this book that describes that.
Sure, be glad to. Marjorie and I have been hosting a fundraiser at the President's Mansion, and finally the party's over. Another big affair, 200 people. The caterers are cleaning up in the restaurant-sized kitchen. We hear the clatter of dishes and the ping of glassware. Marge and I peek in to say goodnight to Barbara, who runs the household and marshals the troops, and then take the elevator up to the second floor, where we've carved out an apartment, offices, an exercise room, a bedroom, and a sitting room. And there are two lovely high-ceilinged guest rooms, each with their own bath. On the third floor, there's a cozy kitchen, which we use to take our meals when it's just the two of us, a ballroom, and a rooftop solarium that looks out over Audubon Park. It's a house on a massive scale with its Corinthian columns, cascade of stone steps, wraparound porches, and huge interior spaces, with an outsized history to match. If these walls could speak, they do speak, of grand ambitions and accomplishments from an older time. Chiefly, they speak of Sam Zemuri, born Shamil Zemur, in Russia, a Jewish immigrant who, starting out in Alabama and then moving to New Orleans as a young man, bought ripe bananas cheaply from importers, who customarily discarded them and sold the produce locally to grocers up and down major trafficking routes. From that beginning, he built a fortune as the Banana King, ultimately controlling the United Fruit Company and evolving himself in Latin American politics, shall we say, a hands-on way in order to keep his import business going. Sam Zemuri bought the house from William Jay, the cotton broker and lumberman who built it and lived there until 1961, when he donated it to Tulane for use as the President's Mansion. In the last 50 years, several families have occupied it, but we're the ones, or really Marjorie's the one, who repurposed it for modern times with the help of grandson Sam Zemuri Stone, who supplied the money for the renovation. Much we kept the same, including the paneled mahogany, the intricate plastic work on ceilings and moldings, the leaded windows, the wooded floors. The chief changes, the creation of third-floor kitchen and a redo of the ballroom, where an organ, since put into storage, had been built into the wall, living quarters on the second floor, a new reception hall, and powder rooms on the first floor. University artworks on the walls, new paint, reupholstered furniture, and the construction of a wall to close off the staircase from public access. Marjorie had heard even velvet ropes didn't keep curious guests from wandering upstairs to the family bedrooms. The more public life, the more you need a private retreat away from the wanderers. We're stepping to our private lives tonight after the reception. As we get off the elevator, Gibson, our golden retriever, joyfully slides across the polished wood floor and jumps up to lick our faces. When our children are in town, the grandchildren provide the patter of little feet or the thump of sneakers up and down the halls and staircases. I strip off my tie, throw off my suit jacket, and head to the exercise bike, where I could look out the window at the lights shining up and down St. Charles Avenue or watch a movie while I put in my minutes. Ever since the storm, the exercise room has been the place to work out the stress and to get a calmer place. It's a house, the president's mansion of architectural lore and New Orleans history, but it's also home.
It is, and it's nice for people to see it that way. So this is a book about one man, one university, the recovery of a city, philosophy of leadership, all these things. What is it you want people to take away from it?
You know, I think above all else, it is the power of one, what individuals working by themselves and collectively can do to revitalize a community. When I think about what happened after Katrina here in New Orleans, it wasn't the federal government or the state government or the local government that rebuilt New Orleans. It was individuals like you and me. And the collective impact of our efforts is what has made this city better. So if there's one thing is, it is that empowered people can make a real difference. And when I speak across, you know, the country, which I've been doing, not just about the book, but about New Orleans, that's the one message I leave everybody. Leadership is not about being president of Tulane University or CEO of a company. Leadership is about one individual providing, if you will, an example for others and inspiring others to do things they didn't think was possible. That's what happened here in New Orleans. Ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And that's the message that I want people to get out of the book.
And we are lucky to live here. I love that story of you coming down to look at Tulane and thinking, yeah, I could live there. I could live there.
When we came down in the 1990s, it was really foreign to us in many ways. We had really never been to New Orleans before. And we thought we could live here, but we wondered. And here it is 16 years later, and it's become a place that we dearly love and know that, you know, we'll spend the rest of our life in New Orleans.
And you're sticking around. Yeah. Well, we've been talking with outgoing Tulane University President Scott Cowan, whose new book is The Inevitable City, The Resurgence of New Orleans, and the Future of Urban America. You can meet him Tuesday, June 10th at 7 at the Jewish Community Center, or you could meet him Monday, June 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
And I know we can make it.
I know that we can.
I know done well we can work it out.
Oh, yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can. Why can't we if we want to? Yes, we can.
I know we can make it work.
I know that we can.
I know we can make it if we try.
Oh, yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can. Great gosh almighty. Yes, we can. I know we can.
Stephen Ray is with us today. He's going to be one of the readers for Bloomsday, which is coming up June 16th at 6 p.m. at the Irish House on St. Charles Avenue. Stephen's also the author of Finn McCool's Football Club, The Birth, Death, and Resurrection of a Pub Soccer Team in the City of the Dead. And he will be teaching creative writing for Loyola's Writing Institute this summer, as well as coaching a summer soccer camp. Busy guy. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
So Bloomsday is going to be at the Irish House again, and it's a fabulous celebration of James Joyce's Ulysses, sponsored by Crescent City Books and put together by Michael Allen Zell. Anybody can read, up to 10 minutes, time permitting, but guest readers this year include Brian Boyles, Pandora Gastelum, Maurice Carlos Ruffin, and members of the New Orleans Poetry Brothel. I'll be there, too. And so will Stephen. So is that how you got involved? Did Michael rope you into this?
I did. This event and sometime around St. Patrick's Day, I'm often the token Irishman that gets asked to do things. If there's a library in New Orleans, they usually call me up.
And,
yes, you know, it's St. Patrick's Day. Will you come in and read? Sure, why not? I think people think because I'm 5 foot six, actually, I'm a real leprechaun, but I'm not. But do you know what I was wondering? You know, like, I remember when I went to Havana, and you go and you look and say Hemingway or whatever it may be, there are certain authors, and they're obviously, in fact, as we know here, obviously with Tennessee Williams, and you might go and see the bar they went to or the room that they wrote this. But is this unique in that for one day around the world, this is a place that people all over the world come together to celebrate a single author? apart, maybe Shakespeare's birthday, perhaps. Yeah, yeah.
I kind of think so. I think you're right.
Yeah, okay.
I love it that we do it. And it celebrates one of the most famous real dates in history.
Yes.
The day Joyce went out with his future wife, Nora Barnacle, for the first time in 1904. So this is the 110th.
Yes.
Hard to believe. Ah. So, I've heard you say that Ulysses actually isn't one of your favorite books.
Shh. Yeah, I have to admit, I am a much bigger fan of modern fiction. And I much prefer contemporary authors and a lot of crime novels and perhaps stuff that's a bit darker. However, having said that, of course, you have to recognize the brilliance, not just so much the brilliance of the actual book, because as you quite rightly say, I'm not the biggest fan. I remember being forced to read parts of it in school and hating it back then. But I think the fact that this is a, what we might say, a genre-bursting novel or perhaps a real pivotal moment in literature, in the sense that there were so many different ways that he wrote and so many things that we now take for granted, you know, such as the stream of conscious thing that 100 years ago was complete without punctuation, which was really groundbreaking, and all the way up now to more modern, even some of the English soccer books I read that are written from the point of view of soccer hooligans.
Uh-huh.
They have, you know, adapted all that kind of stuff. And to think that it's sometimes, especially with literature, in my writing class, we were saying this the other night, everything has been done, everything has been written. And sometimes you forget that there was a time that everything hadn't been done and nobody had written 800 pages about one day from two different protagonists and using all these different, you know, flashbacks and changes of scenery and changes of point of view and all that kind of stuff that we take for granted now. So I can recognize, without as fudging, sitting on the fence as I would tend to do, I'm not a great fan of the book, but I can certainly recognize the genius.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's this wonderful book that celebrated the 100th anniversary of Bloomsday called Yes, I Said Yes, I Will, Yes, a celebration of James Joyce, Ulysses, and 100 Years of Bloomsday, and had a foreword by Frank McCourt, which was so wonderful. But one of the things they assembled in this book were quotes from people who did and didn't like it. And Tennessee Williams wrote a college term paper on Ulysses and said, "A great deal of dullness, then some dirt, then some dullness, then a great deal more dirt and a great deal more dullness. That is my impression of Ulysses." So there you go.
And whenever you teach writing, I think you look at things differently. And there are tenets of good writing that you have to enforce. But just because I think this and you think that, it doesn't make anybody's point of view more valid or less valid. You know, who am I to say that this isn't a great work of fiction? But it's my opinion, and mm-hmm. I'm entitled to it. And everyone, you know, if somebody like Tennessee Williams, it doesn't perhaps do us good that we're here to publicize an event and we're spending longer talking about what's wrong with it and why we don't like it. But hey, everyone's entitled to their own opinion.
But there is something so, so special about hearing it. About group reading, you know. The first year I went, everyone sat around a table and we just started at the beginning and everybody read two pages. And some people passed. And, you know, you didn't have to read. Some people just listened. But there is something so endearing about that collective effort to share a book. So what did you choose to read?
I chose something right at the start of the book, around the second page, for two reasons. One, I think it's so important that you grip your reader right from the start. You know, the sort of industry standard is for the first five pages. You need to have interested your reader. You need to have gripped them by the first few pages. So I always tend to go to the start just to see how things are laid out. And the second reason is obviously related to Homer's work, is that this section relates to Telemachus. And I do have a soft spot. There's a certain pub which is at the intersection of Telemachus and Banks called Finn McCool's, as you well know. And I think if you can pick anything that relates to a place that is my second home in New Orleans, well, then I'm certainly not going to miss that opportunity.
Perfect.
So Buck Mulligan's gay voice went on. "My name is absurd too, Malachy Mulligan, two dactyls. But it has a Hellenic ring, hasn't it? Tripping and sunny like the buck himself. We must go to Athens. Will you come if I can get the aunt to fork out 20 quid? He laid the brush aside and, laughing with delight, cried, "Will he come, the Jesuit?" Ceasing, he began to shave with care. "Tell me, Mulligan," Stephen said quietly. "Yes, my love? How long is Haynes going to stay in this tower?" Buck Mulligan showed a shaven cheek over his right shoulder. "God, isn't he dreadful?" he said frankly. "A ponderous Saxon. He thinks you're not a gentleman. God, these bloody English." Bursting with money and indignation, "because he comes from Oxford. You know, Dedalus, you have the real Oxford manner. He can't make you out. Oh, my name for you is the best. Kinch, the knife blade." He shaved warily over his chin. "He was raving all night about a black panther," Stephen said. "Where is his gun case?" "A woeful lunatic," Mulligan said. "Well, you're in a funk." "I was," Stephen said, with energy and growing fear. "Out here in the dark with a man I don't know raving and moaning to himself about shooting a black panther. You saved men from drowning. I'm not a hero, however. If he stays on here, I'm off." And the fact that it makes fun of the English is totally coincidental, I should say.
You could do the audiobook. It would be fabulous.
Well, I did discover, I only found this out recently, that the actor Stephen Ray, whose name is spelled exactly the same as mine mm-hmm. and is from my hometown, and we share an optometrist in Belfast, he was actually in a version of Ulysses, a movie called Bloom in 2003. So there you go.
Talk about one degree of separation. That's amazing. Well, the food and beer will be great at the Irish House. I think we'll all have a good time. We've been talking with Stephen Ray. Thanks to Michael Allen Zell of Crescent City Books for setting up this year's Bloomsday celebration. You can join in June 16th at 6 o'clock at the Irish House, 1472 St. Charles Avenue. Bring your copy of Ulysses and we'll see you there. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Thank you.
In one of my favorite novels, Hilma Wolitzer's Summer Reading, a woman who leads book groups contemplates her life. She thinks, and the idea, the fad of summer reading, as if books were seasonal commodities like sun-ripened tomatoes or root vegetables, slightly offended her. But she was as responsible as anyone for advertising and encouraging it. The whole thing, this leading of groups, was a bit of an act by now, she knew. Not much more than a literary shtick. Teachers and writers were always spouting their favorite cliches about art and life as if they were undeniably true and had just been inspired by a fresh insight. What idiot couldn't figure out for herself that life was short and art was long? But in this story of summer reading, with its twists and turns, we gradually do begin to see that summer reading can be special. Those books that we choose on our own for no rhyme or reason might stay with us forever. Vacation reading choices take so many different forms. For some of us, it's the bestseller we never have time to catch up with when we're not on vacation. And there will be lots of those this summer, from James Lee Burke and Stephen King and Dean Koontz, to name only a few of my favorites. Neglected classics? I don't know many people who read those, though I do know a few folks who concentrate on a single author for the summer months. One of my neighbors once read nothing but short stories for the summer, which seems like a lovely idea. I sometimes hope I'll get a jump on the books I need to read for the fall. This year, for example, the Dickens Fellowship of New Orleans will be reading Bleak House, but I may put that one off until September, and that's how I get into trouble. For kids, reading is often drawn from that school-provided list, something to be gotten out of the way early or put off to the very last minute. My kids certainly tried both approaches. And then there were those blissful years when we were waiting for new Harry Potter novels. Now those were summers to remember. My summer reading is a wonderful combination of things. I have books to read for the reading life, of course, but I manage to sneak in a lot of Scandinavian murder mysteries, my favorite guilty pleasure. I like beginning the summer with Bloomsday, looking back at Ulysses and thinking about what would be fun to read aloud. I always look for an author to revisit. This summer, I'm looking forward to rereading the work of Colette. It's nice to reconnect with a favorite author's newest work, as I've done with Tom Robbins' Tibetan Peach Pie. Then there's the fun of finding a new favorite novel, like Roxane Gay's An Untamed State, or Joel Dicker's The Truth About the Harry Cabert Affair. And I always try to read one book for inspiration, and for that, I'm looking to Philippe Petit's creativity, The Perfect Crime. Then there are the necessary books. It's just not a summer vacation unless I try out a new barbecue cookbook. My son comes home from grad school this week, and it will be my pleasure to cook for him. My daughter and I both have new puppies, Hugo and Wilson. So there's the vital reading of dog training manuals and subsequent comparing of notes and daily mischief. This will be the summer I will remember the sweet pleasure of reading with Wilson's golden head in my lap. But all too soon, those sweet dark eyes beg me to play instead. And that's what summer should be. Play with your kids, play with your dogs, and of course, play with your books too. It's time to lighten up and slow down. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Jeanette Wall signs The Silver Star, Tuesday, June 10th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Scott Cowan, discusses and signs The Inevitable City, The Resurgence of New Orleans, and The Future of Urban America, Tuesday, June 10th at 7 at the Jewish Community Center Uptown. Cowan also appears Monday, June 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Maple Street Bookshop hosts a reading featuring contributors to Plume, the influential online poetry journal, Thursday, June 12th at 6 at the Maple Street Bookshop. Featured readers include Carrie Causey, Peter Cooley, Benjamin Lohenkron, Brad Richard, and Christopher Shipman. Andre Debuse III signs the new paperback edition of Dirty Love, Thursday, June 12th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Octavia Book Science Fiction Book Club discusses Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie, Saturday, June 14th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Fiction writer Louis Crowder reads from and signs his new novella, In Irons, Sunday, June 15th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Bloomsday, the annual celebration of James Joyce's Ulysses, sponsored by Crescent City Books, takes place Monday, June 16th at 6 at the Irish House, 1432 St. Charles Avenue. Guest readers include Brian Boyles, Pandora Gastelum, today's guest, Stephen Ray, Maurice Carlos Ruffin, members of the New Orleans Poetry Brothel, and me. But anyone can read, up to 10 minutes max. If you want to work on your creative writing skills this summer, Loyola University's Walker Percy Center is offering several 8-week, evening, non-credit courses through the Writing Institute. Find out more at loino.edu/WPC. Offerings at the Uptown campus include writing creative nonfiction with C.W. Cannon, writing the short story with Michael Jeffrey Lee. At the Healing Center, John Cron will teach writing poetry, and Jessica Kinnison will teach developing a writing practice. Stephen Ray will teach writing well-crafted fiction in Covington. Most courses start mid-June, but consult the website for fees and registration forms. Deadline for enrollment is June 14th. And coming up soon, Festigals, that great girlfriend's weekend here in New Orleans, June 19th through 22nd. Authors appearing include Amy Parnes, co-author of HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton, Lisa Gabrielle, author of The Secret series, Laurel House, Screwing the Rules, Maximizing Your Success by Being a Power Feminine, and Virginia Barclay, Chaos to Calm. Check out festigals.org for more info. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.